Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes as we recognize the 75th anniversary of the infamous Bataan Death March by listening to stories from men who survived it. It just struck me how diverse the four men that we're hearing from today happen to be, but how similar their experience on the march turned out to be. We have one Italiano from California, a Kentucky native of Cherokee heritage, a native of New Mexico, a state that had more of its sons on the march than any other state, and finally, a Filipino who is still going strong at age 96 and has just published a book about some of his experiences. You'll find a link to that book at hometownheroesradio.com and on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. But for now, we're going back into the archives for one of the earliest editions of this program. In fact, it was only the fifth episode 10 years ago, and the recording quality may indicate as much, but the memories are pretty powerful. From Wild Bill Begley, who grew up in Hyden, Kentucky, spent much of his life in Squaw Valley, California, and passed away last year at the age of 94. He had joined the Army Air Corps and arrived at Clark Field in the Philippines not long before the war broke out. He would soon be fighting on foot with obsolete weapons, little protection, and eventually nothing in terms of food supplies. I do want to warn you that some of the candid descriptions you're going to hear from Wild Bill in a few minutes are pretty gruesome and really a shock to the system. But here's how Bill explained the situation in the days and weeks leading up to the death march.
Well, we had a saying, if it moves, eat it. If it stands still, we salute it. We ate monkeys and snakes, lizards, anything that walked, crawled, or flew, we ate. We were starving, actually. We ran out of food whenever General MacArthur sent word by General King for us to surrender. We didn't want to, none of us did, but that was the orders of the day. And we stacked up our rifles and went out to the road. And there's where the real terrible things happen. I was already in bad shape. I went from 180 pounds to about 110 approximately. And the reason is we didn't have any food. And like I said, if it moved, eat it. If it stood still, we always said salute it.
But then once you're on the march, you don't even have the opportunity to do that. If you get out of line, even if you stop to get a drink of water, you might get shot, you might get bayoneted, you might get decapitated. You saw all of those things happen, didn't you?
Yes, unfortunately, I witnessed all of that kind of stuff. I walked approximately about 100 miles, I suppose. It was a terrible ordeal because they didn't give us any rest. We couldn't get any water. I went on the march. I was on it about 10 days, approximately. And I didn't get any food, didn't get any water. Guys would drop out, and they'd try to help one another, and it was pitiful. If you stopped, they'd either shoot or bayonet you. They seemed to enjoy bayoneting more than anything else. The thing about it is they also got some women and children, unfortunately, they wouldn't let them out. They finally did. Quite a few of the Philippine soldiers, they slipped off into the forest, and if they got caught, they'd get shot, or bayoneted. So you had to be careful. We stopped at one place. I think it was the town of San Fernando. They lectured us in Japanese. They had an interpreter that would tell us what he's saying. They said you'd be shot and you'd be bayoneted. You had to do what they wanted to. And if you dared to get off the road, see a dirty ditch full of filthy water, a lot of guys would be desperate and they'd make a break for it. And they'd shoot them and bayonet them. It was pretty horrible. Later, when we made a stop, There's a bunch of Japanese officers who were drinking and enjoying themselves, and they taunt us. We did get to sit down. And every now and then they'd pick out 10 men, make them dig a hole in the ground. They would use their two-handed samurai sword, and they tried to first see if they could decapitate a guy with one lick.
And this is a living person standing in this hole they dug.
Yeah, they'd make you come to attention, and they'd walk away. Mm. Then later, they got tired of that because they got blood all over their uniforms and their equipment. So they decided to change it, and they lined us up about 10 again. You dig a hole, then they'd come around behind and shoot you in the back of the head. You'd fall in.
Mm.
That went on until they got tired. We walked day and night. No food, no water. It's a terrible ordeal. I remember in particular two incidents that still come to mind. There's a lady, we went through a little barrio, they call that a town. She had a little boy about 3 years old. The thing about it was he stuck his finger up and said V for victory. When he did, a Japanese guard happened to be close by, and he bayoneted the little feller. Mm. And he raised him up, and he tried to fling him off his bayonet, and his mother screamed. She ran out there, and she tried to cover him, and the guard bayoneted her, and she died right there. And one other particular incident that was bad was two chaplains were going across the bridge along with the rest of us, and one of them decided, well, this is too much, and he jumped, and the other chaplain ran around and tried to get to him, and when he did, the guard motioned him back and didn't want to get to him, but he insisted. So he shot him, and then he bayoneted him. They died holding hands.
Mm. Unbelievably horrific things that you witnessed, and I know that you endured, too. I know that you estimate you were bayoneted yourself 30 times. You were wounded 5 times in the war. After the march was over, you were still a prisoner of war for another 3.5 years before you were liberated, wasting away to 68 pounds. By the time you were liberated, from 180 to 68, if you're listening at home and can just imagine what that must be like. I know it's the obvious answer to the question, did you ever think you were going to die, was yes. You probably had to think about that every day. But what was it that kept you going and that kept you believing that you might be able to make it home and marry and have a family and have the kind of life that you were fighting to preserve?
Well, I didn't have no fancy thoughts about marrying or anything like that. I worried whether or not I'd ever get through and survive. That was the main consideration. And under the circumstances, it was a pretty hard row. You wonder what made me keep going and whatnot. Well, later on, we got into some barracks and whatnot. I seen guys actually more or less commit suicide because they couldn't take it until they picked us up and sent us by ship to Mukden, Manchuria. There we got a little better consideration because they put us in, most of us, in the tool and die factory where they made the tools for machinery or plane parts or anything. Everybody, 100% of us, sabotaged everything. They had guards right over us, and we'd put filings in the oil and all kinds of stuff.
It had been years since I'd listened back to that interview with Bataan Death March survivor Wild Bill Begley, but the will to survive and to foil the enemy at every opportunity, even while wasting away to skin and bones, it leaves such a powerful impression. There was one more thought that Bill shared when I asked him why he spent decades traveling up and down California as part of a military honor guard for countless burials of veterans.
Well, when we got to O'Donnell, the first prisoner of war camp, the guys were dying so fast, it was terrible. The ones that were standing and able to walk and carry somebody, we'd get a door off of a hut, and four of us get on it. Many times before we got to the hole in the ground where we'd have to throw them in there, maybe half of the guys, and I've seen as many as four of the stretcher bearers, would die en route. Mm. It was pretty tough.
It is just unbelievable to imagine how these courageous men persevered amidst those conditions. But every Death March survivor I've talked to echoes a similar storyline, and that includes those from New Mexico, which had more men on the march than any other state in the Union. And that includes those from New Mexico, which had more men on the march than any other state in the Union. One of them was a man named Julio Barella. And even before the march started, things had gotten pretty bleak for Julio. He and his fellow members of the 200th Coast Artillery in the Philippines were undersupplied, ill-equipped, and had no hope of reinforcements.
We don't surrender until we run out of everything. We were starving, eating weeds and stuff like that in order to survive. And that's where the death march started.
Now, when you started that march, you had no idea how long it was going to go. And you're already starving, right?
We started at Death March pretty weak. We were pretty weak then because when we were fighting, we didn't have enough to eat. First thing, we were getting only two meals a day, and then they cut us to one meal a day. And then after that, we didn't have anything to eat. So,
what kept you going? How did you continue on? Because I'm sure a lot of guys were falling by the side and probably getting shot or bayoneted. And you were seeing guys fall left and right. What kept you going? How do you think you survived?
To survive? Well, we used to hunt. We used to eat weeds and stuff like that. Then a lot of them died with malaria, and a lot of them with diarrhea, according to what they eat, see. And part of them died in the death march, and then the other part died in concentration camp.
Did you ever think that you were going to die?
I thought I was going to die, but I just got to where I didn't care. It was just like this. See, I used to worry a lot about my folks, about my mother. I used to worry every day. And one day I said to myself, "Why hell, I'm nothing but a doggone stupid. I'm not going to worry about them because they're better off than I am. They're not having as much trouble as I am having it." The other boys, they feel the same way. We got to where we forgot all about our folks and about the living life. Maybe we were just lucky because when they surrendered, a lot of them died of starvation. A lot of them, they didn't have anything to eat. They were weak, malaria, dysentery, and all that, a lot of disease. Well, we got to where we didn't care. We used to help the ones that couldn't walk. By the Japanese, the ones that couldn't walk, they shoot them. When a man lay down and he can't get up, why, they shoot him. So if they were punish you when you were in concentration camp, they punished me and they knocked me down. And then I have in mind that if I try to stand up and get up, I won't be killed. So, see, that's a lesson the hard way.
I'll say that's a great way to put it, learning the hard way indeed. And every survivor of the Death March that I've interviewed over the years has told me really the same thing that you just did. No one knows exactly how many people died on the march. I've seen estimates of around 10,000 or so. And who knows how many died later because of what they went through on the march. But I know that you Americans helped each other, and you got a lot of help from the Filipinos, who, from what I've seen, statistically outnumbered Americans on the march about 7-1. But all of you were not only marching 61 miles through deep layers of dust, you really didn't have any kind of nourishment. How bad was it? How bad in terms of what you had to eat and drink?
They make us wait 3 days before they could start giving us a bowl of rice, just how much they can grab on a bowl of rice. And that's when the death march starts. And I started walking. It was out of water. And then in concentration camps, we were there starving all the time that we were in prison camp. We never did get anything much to eat. And they were Filipinos. They would try to help us, give us food. They find out that that Filipino tried to help POWs. They would shoot them, burn their kids, burn their homes. They act like they were not civilized. We never have a dream that we was going to survive. We never thought we was going to make it.
Do you remember how much you weighed before?
I weighed about 145, 150. I never been very heavy. But when I was liberated, I weighed 83 pounds.
Your liberation. You survived the march to Camp O'Donnell. You'd been in another infamous camp at Kibanatuan. They took you over to Japan on a hell ship. And in late August of 1945, the atomic bombs had been dropped. The war was coming to an end. And finally, your camp at Niigata, Japan, was liberated. What do you remember about that? What do you remember about tasting freedom again for the first time in more than 3.5 years?
We're very, very weak. Our mind was very weak, and our bodies very weak. We couldn't hardly do much work. We just hope and pray that someday the war will be over. We were working in a foundry. They never gave us a day off, so we noticed that it was a surprise to us. That the Japanese said that we were going to get 3 days off, that we have to stay in camp. So we were anxious to hear the Japanese commander telling us that we have surrendered. And the American officer asked the Japanese, what happened? Nothing. You people won the war. The war is over. Now you people take over tonight. What the Japanese told the American commander, you take care of your prisoners, not to go out because they're going to get killed, because the Japanese don't like the American prisoners, and they're going to get killed if they go out of the camp. So better stay in the camp, so we stay there, you know, until the next day. Then the next day, they go three planes, and they drop us leaflets, saying that if we would clear the area, they will drop packages.
So they dropped some leaflets. They said, get out of the way. We don't want to kill you with the food we want to drop for you. And then you finally got to go outside of the walls of that camp. You'd been living in, I would imagine, and you have described what would be a bleak, seemingly hopeless world for so long, only praying that you'd make it out alive. So not to be too cliched, but did it feel like a dream come true or a prayer answered when you got to come home? What did that feel like?
Well, we had plenty to eat. Every place we go, we just give us something to eat and stuff like that. And it was pretty hard to tell the whole story about it. And I don't know. And some people, the prisoners of war I have talked to, they feel the same way that I feel. They didn't want to talk about it. They got to where they didn't want to talk about it. That's funny. We do more talking now than we did before. We never did say anything because everywhere we go, we start asking us, do you have any Japanese that we killed and all that? None.
Let me ask you this. How often do you think about the other prisoners of war who didn't get to come home? Do you ever think about that, about all the guys who died over there?
I dream more about them than I dream about my people, even today. Every day I remember about some of the prisoners.
Do you ever think that could have been you? Do you ever think about how you could have died there?
Yeah, surprises me that I made it. I sometimes don't even believe it. Being so long and I've getting old and all that, I sometimes don't believe it. I made it. I don't believe it. I went through all of that.
It certainly defies reason. That was Julio Barella of New Mexico, which has several moving memorials to the Bataan Death March. There's a memorial march in Las Cruces every year, attended by thousands, including some survivors that show up year after year. There's a park there in Las Cruces featuring a statue of three men helping each other along with footprints in the concrete in front and behind those figures, and those prints were actually cast from the feet of Death March survivors. In Albuquerque, Bataan Park was a gathering place during the war for families whose loved ones were in captivity, and today a monument there pays tribute to those who died on the march, as well as those who survived. In Albuquerque this weekend, a dozen survivors are gathering to mark the 75th anniversary, and one of them is 96-year-old Atilano David, a native of the Philippines. We'll hear some of his story and why he's decided to become a nonagenarian author when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.